Chapter 25.
Planet Ankuril. 3 days before Operation Ringbreaker.
The Thunderstrike's communications array had melted in the attack on the flotilla. A pilot on his promise wasn't equipped for interstellar encryption. So Namir and Brand spent most of the morning combing through cramped shops and junkyards, searching for a dealer who would sell them the parts they needed to make contact with whatever was left of Alliance High Command. They didn't find anyone willing. Ignoring Twilight Company was one thing. The citizens of Ankuril seemed happy to turn a blind eye, particularly when a few credits were in the mix. But no one wanted to get involved, and Twilight's engineers had already reported difficulty obtaining wires and tubing and scrap metal. Illegal transmitters and code sequencers were a step too far. By noon, Namir and Brand had silently agreed to make do with someone unwilling. In a curio shop, where animal tusks and vials of silver fluid were piled alongside data pads and retinal spiders, Brand whispered something into the proprietor's ear while Namir held a scalpel-flourishing droid at gunpoint. The proprietor disappeared into the back before returning with a box of metal devices marked with the Imperial crest. He shouted something in an alien language as the two left the shop, the box safely nestled under Namir's left arm. "What did you say?" Namir asked.
"Something that will only work once," Brand said, glancing over her shoulder as she led the way through the city's back alleys.
It was more of an answer than Namir had expected. He decided to press his luck. "What did he say?" he asked.
"He thought we were a couple," Brand said.
Namir laughed until Brand cast him an irritated look. His joy faded, however, as they approached the pod racing track, and the fears and burdens that had claimed him the night before enveloped him like a shroud. He still had no idea how to give Twilight Company what it needed. Once the communications rig was in place, getting a response was a matter of patience and prayer. The Thunderstrike sent three messages to three separate Alliance relay stations, hoping one would be routed to a ship or a base that hadn't been destroyed. That in itself was a risk. If the Empire had located the relays, there was a chance the messages could be traced. Namir didn't understand the mechanics, but he trusted the word of the surviving bridge crew. Ensigns or not, they were still Alliance Navy, and that meant they'd read operating manuals for equipment with names Namir couldn't even pronounce. The senior officers traded comm duty for the rest of the day and into the night. Any channel open to the Alliance wasn't likely to stay open long, and someone from Twilight had to be ready to seize any opportunity for communication, however brief. Namir had come to relieve Von Guise early in the morning when he arrived in Howe's office and saw the old doctor staring at a shimmering blue hologram.
"Most of High Command survived, but the fleet is scattered, and the Empire is hunting strays."
The image pixelated, turned to static, reassembled into the upper body of a non-uniformed boy younger than Namir. His words were difficult to pick out. A droid would have sounded more human.
"I can't guess when they'll reassemble."
Von Guise nodded slowly.
"And the princess?" he asked.
There was a long delay before the boy answered. Namir couldn't tell whether the cause was human or technical.
"Gone missing. We know she's alive. The Empire's committed massive resources to finding her, but that's all."
Von Guise nodded again and looked to Namir. Namir gestured to the medic, prompting him to proceed.
"Is there anyone," Von Guise asked, "with command authority who we can reach, or a general order for surviving ships?"
Again, the delay.
"Not that I'm aware of. I'm sorry, Thunderstrike. Good luck."
The hologram blinked out. Von Guise spoke softly, watching the air above the projector as if he expected the call to resume.
"As we surmised, we're on our own."
Namir leaned against the wall in the cramped room and folded his arms across his chest. "Hal trusted you. What would he do now?"
Von Geis laughed.
Something only Howl could do, I'm sure, he said. Better to ask ourselves this. What can we do without him?
Namir steeled himself before the door to Howl's quarters. He knew what he would find inside, and he knew he needed to stay calm. But when he tried to picture the exchanges and arguments that might ensue, tried to ready himself for unpleasantness, his mind found no purchase and slid into the gray void that had haunted him since Hoth. He was too exhausted to predict anything. To hell with preparation and speeches. He tapped the keypad and stepped through the doorway. The room wasn't luxurious, even by twilight standards. It was barely larger than the captain's office, with a bunk spanning its length and a trunk and a small desk dominating two walls. The private closet-sized bathroom was its only concession to the privileges of rank. Its decorations were Spartan. Namir suspected Hober had cleared out Howl's belongings before the funeral. Seated on the bunk was Ivari Chalice. She looked small, huddled over a datapad with her head bowed low and her knees together. Her finger rapidly danced across the pad screen. When Namir stepped forward, he caught a glimpse of a face taking shape under her hand. New art project? He asked. Chalice tapped the screen again and erased the sketch. As she looked up, Namir saw that the bruise on her neck had nearly vanished. Just an exercise, she said. Her voice was hoarse but not unnatural. Namir wondered if that was as close as she would come to healing. Then he banished the question from his mind. It didn't matter. I need your advice, he said. Chalice looked back down at the blank screen and began sketching again. You told me, Namir said, that all you really wanted was comfort, respect, and a place to sculpt. You said you'd overthrow the Empire to get your life back. He felt an urge to snatch the datapad from her hands, but he suppressed it. I don't see how any of that has changed. You're still stuck with Twilight Company. Even if you were free, my guess is the people of Ankura would sell you to the Empire in an eye blink. Chalice said nothing. Her body was too low over the datapad for Namir to observe her line work. You know the Empire better than anyone here, he said, forcing his voice not to shake with irritation. High Command is out of the picture. Without a plan, we're all dead. Are you a true believer now, too? Chalice asked. Namir had to strain to hear her. No, Namir said, but I'm not abandoning Twilight either. Chalice made a soft, noncommittal sound. Namir waited. He studied the woman before him, tried to remember if she'd always been so gaunt, if her shoulder blades and cheekbones had always been so prominent, if the white streaks in her hair had stood out so brightly on Hedoral Prime. He watched the muscles in her arm twitch like those of a dying animal as she moved her fingers over the pad. He tried not to wonder what was happening in her mind. He knew her too well to believe he could sway her. As he turned to leave, however, she spoke again. I grew up like you did, Chayla said, though she didn't look up. Not on your particular colonial disaster, but close enough. Crucible, Namir said. It was called Crucible. Chalice didn't seem to hear him. We had nothing, she said. My mother tried to sell me to a Trade Federation exploratory vessel when I was 6. I was too small. Out of pity, the captain gave me a packet of Nectro's crystals. Imagine this little girl who sleeps on her mother's stained mattress in the ruins of a bombed-out paper mill. Nectros, you're supposed to sprinkle it in water. It makes things sweet and fruity. But I didn't know that. I didn't have fresh water. I'd stick my fingers in the crystals and lick them off. I rationed them, gave myself a treat once a week for months. I broke out in hives every time. It was the most wonderful thing I'd ever encountered. That was how I knew I had to leave my world. It was how I realized I was living in filth, eating garbage and drinking poison, when off-worlders were so rich they could throw Nectro's packets to children. Something had changed in Chalice's voice. It took Namir time to recognize it beneath the rasp, but her accent had changed. Once again, the strange over-enunciation was gone, and the way she spoke was suddenly familiar. She almost sounded like she was from Crucible. I got into the Colonial Academy. How isn't important. I trained as an artist. I made it off-world and found I was still the lowest of the low. A pretty savage, rich sponsors put to work as a novelty. Under the Republic, I had nowhere to go. I could scrabble and claw against the sides of the pit until my hands bled and never climb out. When the Empire rose, it wasn't kind to me, but it rewarded success. Count Vidian saw some quality in my sculpture, an ability to visualize concepts in a way he couldn't. He offered me an apprenticeship, and my art fell to the wayside. I did horrible things, Sergeant. I proposed mining the atmosphere of an inhabited planet, leaving its people wheezing the rest of their lives. I found ways to make slavery efficient again. I told Amoth I loved him and slit his throat as a favor to another. But I thought it was worth it. I climbed to the top of the hierarchy by being a damn good advisor. I earned the respect of men who thought generations of good breeding was the key to success. Her tone had become bitter, and specks of spittle dotted the front of her datapad. Her shoulders rose and fell even before she began coughing. What started as a dry rasp became wet and mucosal, like the heaves of a woman rotting on the inside. Namir merely watched, waited. He felt neither sympathy nor pity. Finally, the coughing subsided. A few moments later, Chalas resumed. "Now I know the truth," she said. For the second time since he'd entered the room, she looked up at Namir. "The truth?" he asked. "I never had respect," Chalas said. "The Moths never considered me an equal. Darth Vader never considered me a threat. The Emperor sent Prelate Verge, a brainless sycophant, after me while Vader was," she waved a hand dismissively, "chasing rebels. The ruling council never saw me as anything but a runt of a sculptor from a backwater planet. I gave up everything to defect, and they barely even cared." Namir felt heat prickle beneath the skin of his forehead. The words drew forth something he'd thought he had left behind on the journey to Hoth. A frustrated, fitful anger at Chalice for the curse she'd brought on Twilight Company, the curse he had brought onto Twilight Company by not killing her on Hadoral Prime. "Lieutenant Sargon and the others," he said, voice low and steady, "are dead because of how little the Empire cared about you. So are Fectron and Ajax. But you don't know their names, do you?" She was still looking at him. Namir stepped forward and knelt in front of the governor, placing himself level with her. Her eyes were bloodshot, her pupils dilated. "You owe this company," he said, "and you owe me. Stop pitying yourself and help me save these people. I gave the rebellion everything I had on Hoth," Chalice said. She looked back at her screen. Squatting so close to her, Namir could see the rough image of a wide-eyed, bearded man who might have been Howl. "My debts are paid." When she said nothing else, Namir stood and exited the room. His mouth was suddenly dry and his heart was beating rapidly. Now he had nothing left to hope for. The fight was over by the time Namir got word. Twitch was covered in other people's blood, while Jinsoul had a broken nose and Mei Diyu had come back to the pod racing track, holding the skin of her cheek in place with one hand. "It could have been random," Bran said. "One of the lower-level gangs looking to score cheap blasters, maybe hold our people for ransom." Namir had found her standing on the top tier of the amphitheater, looking out into the city. But you don't believe it. Bran shrugged.
I think it's a message, she said. I think the real powers in Ankuro want us out.
And who are those real powers?
Does it matter?
Brand asked. Probably not, Namir said. Besides, the ship's about ready for takeoff. There's still work that has to happen, but we can handle it during flight.
Assuming we have somewhere to go.
Namir flinched at the statement, though Brand's tone was unassuming. Tomorrow morning, Namir said. Senior staff meeting. We'll figure something out.
Bran's head tilted slightly as she tracked some distant movement in the streets. Whatever she was watching, Namir couldn't see it. Maybe she just didn't want to show her skepticism.
No one would object if you showed up, he went on. You've earned a lot of leeway.
No, Bran said.
No?
I'm not a captain, Bran said.
She was absolutely still, like a gargoyle atop the amphitheater. Then she broke the spell and faced Namir.
I'm not even a soldier.
Meaning? He heard the irritation in his voice, tried too late to conceal it.
Meaning if there's a better way to fight the Empire, I'll take it.
Namir swore and kicked at one of the steps. You really need to say that out loud? I know what happens to this company if we don't come up with a plan. I don't need you threatening to walk too.
Bran's fists flexed, her fingers curling in and out. Finally, she nodded. Sorry, she said, and began to descend.
Namir grunted and followed along. We'll find something out, he repeated softly.
When they reached the pod racing track, Bran turned toward the gates first, then back to touch Namir's shoulder.
I'm glad you found us, she said.
We all are. Most of the fresh meat would be rotten by now without you.
Don't worry about it. Namir shook his head and smiled tightly. You heading into the city?
Hunting, Bran said. Don't tell Twitch I finished a fight for her.
Namir spent the night cursing everything he didn't know. On Crucible, he'd known the factions, known the landscape, known that defending a hill was easier than defending a cornfield. He'd been able to recognize when a battle became hopeless and known how to run or surrender to keep his unit alive. What did he know about fighting a galactic war? The rebellion strategy had always been a mystery to him, and that hadn't mattered. His job was to win planets on the ground, to slog through mud and creep through the night and terrorize the enemy. There was no rebel territory to hold. Those few planets that had fully committed to the Alliance were cordoned behind Imperial blockades, inaccessible to the Thunderstrike. Hitting soft targets, lightly guarded Imperial worlds that Twilight could descend upon, devastate and flee, was almost viable, but without a strategic goal, the company would hemorrhage deserters, not to mention the actual casualties. Even a lie seemed impossible. Namir imagined choosing a planet, any planet, and committing to its conquest. But Twilight Company was mobile for a reason. If it ever lingered, ever became a permanent threat, the Empire could bring massive firepower to bear and annihilate the unit. Every goal he concocted was a phantom, fading at a touch. He ate breakfast, rehydrated powdered eggs imported to Ankuril, and purchased in bulk by one of Hober's assistants an hour before sunup after a sleepless night. As he walked the perimeter of the Thunderstrike, it occurred to him he had forgotten to shave. But he saw no use in hiding his exhaustion. He surveyed the strange tent city and waved to the sentries. He thought he saw Brand trekking in from the gates and wondered if she'd found her prey. He sat in the amphitheater seats watching the dawn of a foreign sun. He wondered if he could convince Brand to take him along if she left. Not that he would go. He couldn't go. Not when the company needed him so badly. His promise
If you can't get behind what they believe in, maybe it's time to walk away still held. And he'd chosen to back his friends, however disastrously it turned out. He was already late for the senior staff meeting by the time he reported the thunderstrike. He resigned himself to a morning of bitter debate and pointless arguments, and hoped that another mind would prevail where his had so badly let him down. When he arrived in the conference room, what he saw made him freeze in the doorway. The senior officers of the company sat around the table or stood along the walls as usual, but while they spoke to one another in low tones, all of them were oriented toward the far end of the table, toward Howell's place. There, Ivari Chalice stood with a data pad, keying instructions into a floating holodroid that hovered over the table. She looked entirely unlike the woman Namir had seen the previous day. She was straight-backed and certain, the bruise on her throat totally invisible, cosmetically concealed, he presumed. Even her hair was different, cropped close around her head in a fashion the Imperial military might have approved of. Only her exhaustion remained unchanged, the gauntness of her cheeks and the redness in her eyes. She looked away from the pad and the droid across the room to Namir, and she smiled. "We're all here," she said. "We may as well start." Chalice's voice was rough, and she paused often as she spoke. Sometimes she turned away from the table entirely, and her shoulders shook and heaved. But except for those brief signs of infirmity, she seemed utterly in control of herself and the room. She never stumbled. She locked gazes with any officer who seemed ready to turn away, smiled with the self-effacing certainty of a rebel determined to overthrow a mighty empire. "This is the Alliance's moment of weakness," she began. "The Emperor intends to deliver the killing blow at last, hunting down the scattered members of Alliance High Command as they flee deep into the galaxy's outer rim. But in the Emperor's would-be triumph, there is also an opportunity. High Command and the Rebel flagships are dispersed, not destroyed. Princess Leia Organa is the target of an unprecedented manhunt." For a moment, Chalice's lips froze into a smile. Namir recognized the bitterness he'd seen the previous day. Then it vanished, and she continued. "Emperor Palpatine, the Moffs, Darth Vader, they've done what they do best, deploying overwhelming force to scour the outer rim of their enemies. And to cover those vast territories, they've moved whole fleets out of position. For the first time in years, the core world's defenses are enervated." There were murmurs about the room. Carver spoke up, openly skeptical. "How do you know?" Chalice flicked her hand dismissively. "I was at Hoth," she said. "I recognized the ships they brought to bear. I've also been monitoring whatever unsecured broadcasts make it to this sandpit, and most important, I know what resources the Empire has and what it doesn't. Pulling fleets from active war zones or the mid-rim border is too risky. Drawing from the core worlds for Vader's operation just makes sense." To Namir's surprise, she waited for a counter-argument. Carver offered none, and she continued. "This vulnerability," she said, "isn't a license for conquest. If we try to strike at the Imperial Palace on Coruscant, we'll be obliterated before the dropships hit atmosphere. But I know how the Imperial war machine functions. I want to make its gears grind and shatter." She snapped her fingers. The hollow droid bobbed over the table and its projectors flared, generating the image of a planet Namir failed to recognize. The planet appeared ordinary enough, covered in clouds and water and land. It might have been any of 100 worlds Namir had visited already, except for the single ring that circled its equator. Were terrestrial planets supposed to have rings? Namir tried to remember what Gadarin had taught him. "This is the planet Kuat," Chalice said.
Its shipyards are the primary source of the Empire's Star Destroyer fleet. I propose we destroy them.
The holographic image flickered and resolved on a magnified portion of the ring. Up close, it appeared to be an immense scaffold in space, bridged and augmented by enormous habitats bristling with machinery. Inside the scaffold, like prisoners caged and left for dead, were the skeletons of wedge-shaped ships, their metal skin only half covering their bodies. Tiny bright dots drifted to and from the skeletons, alighting on the ships or returning to the habitats. "If we succeed," Chalice went on, "our attack will cripple the Empire's fleet-building capacity and deny repairs and upkeep to current vessels. Star Destroyers may be nearly indestructible, but they're the most resource-intensive ships this galaxy has ever seen. Kuat possesses the only shipyards capable of supporting and maintaining more than a handful at a time. Furthermore, stopping the production and repair of Star Destroyers will inhibit the Empire's capacity for fast infantry deployment. No longer would one ship be able to carry thousands of stormtroopers and a full squadron of armored transport walkers. The Empire strategy for planetary containment would need to shift." Namir watched the senior staff. Some were checking their data pads, taking notes, or cross-referencing data. Others watched Jalus or the hologram. Von Guy spoke up.
"The Alliance tried to attack Kuat before," he said. "We're only two ships."
"Kuat's defenses are oriented towards space combat," Chalice said smoothly, as if she'd been expecting the question. "We're an infantry company, and no one's ever tried a ground invasion of the shipyards." She snapped again, and the hologram magnified further, showing tram tracks and enclosures against the backdrop of space. "The orbital ring has a total inhabitable area of less than 300,000 square kilometers, smaller than a typical planetary subnation, and susceptible to unique forms of attack. Imagine urban warfare in a city where you could sever whole blocks from the mainland at the touch of a button, where any damage to the infrastructure was a blow to the enemy. Yes, it will be bloody. But I believe Twilight can succeed."
Namir sensed a wave of discomfort in the room, though no one argued openly. He tried to picture what Chalice was proposing and found it meant nothing to him. Even the numbers were beyond his comprehension. "All that said," she went on, "the Kuat star system's space-based defenses are formidable, even with fleet elements diverted to the outer rim. We need to soften them further in order to safeguard the Thunderstrike's passage to the shipyards." The droid's projection changed to a star map. From a point near the bottom, a line zigzagged toward an upper dot Namir could only assume represented Kuat. "To that end," Chayla said, "we must take an indirect path to Kuat and strike these designated targets. No sieges, no prolonged attacks. These are surgical strikes against logistical hubs. We destroy these, and the Empire must react by reassigning ships and officers, either to repair the damage or to compensate by bolstering efficiency elsewhere. Directly or indirectly, these reassignments will cannibalize Kuat's own defenses."
"You can't possibly know that either,"
Carver again, voice steady, despite his confrontational tone. "I understand the flow of resources within the Empire better than anyone alive," Chayla said. "It's why Captain Ivan accepted me. It's why Alliance High Command needed me. I absolutely know it." She gestured at the droid and the hologram flickered out. The conference room seemed dark without the azure glow. "Sergeant Namir and I have been discussing this plan since we fled Hoth. It will be risky. We'll need to move fast, both on the ground and in space, just to give ourselves a fighting chance. We'll need to maintain operational secrecy so that the Empire doesn't anticipate our true goal. And once we reach Kuat,
everything could go wrong. I can't predict the future. But if you want to turn this war around, I believe this is our best chance.
She didn't look at Namir when she said his name. It came out so casually he might have missed it if not for the others glancing toward him. He knew if he didn't deny his ownership of the plan immediately, any attempt later on would cost him all credibility. And if he did deny he'd been involved, Chalice would be branded a liar and her whole presentation would be thrown into doubt. He chose to say nothing. He barely listened after that. The senior staff began to argue. Hober inundated Chalice with questions about her targets, about Kuat's shifting defenses, and, after a coughing fit that ended only when Von Geis intervened, she answered them readily. Mazoon and Gadrin and Carver debated the tactics of a shipyard invasion. The second in command of Ipilina's Promise, there to represent her ship, shook her head silently in the corner. Namir thought about the promises he'd made. He thought about Gadrin's words and about Hoth. He thought about Krindle, the idiot Alliance Special Forces soldier he'd fought with at Echo Base, and wondered if his lunatic plan to take Coruscant was any less practical. But then this wasn't the plan of a mad ideologue, even if it looked the part. "Do we have any alternatives?" he asked. "Any better plans at all?" The chatter around him quieted and stopped. The senior officers watched him. In those seconds of silence, he prayed someone would answer in the affirmative.
"Would you leave the room?"
Gadrin asked Chalice. His voice was stern, almost too deep for clarity. Chalice nodded politely and exited, the droid floating behind her.
"Howl trusted her, at least in part,"
Gadrin said, now facing Namir.
"Howl trusted you more than you realize, and all of us respect your service to this company. So I ask you, is this what we must do?"
"I don't know," Namir thought. "How could I?"
"Yes," he said. "Then you have my support," Gadrin replied. "Though if we are voting, I will remove myself and thank you all for your forbearance."
"Do we need to be that formal?" Von Geis asked. "Technically, command falls to me after Howl and Sargon and Peonu and, well, Sharn. Would you object to a voice vote?"
The Promise's second-in-command shook her head.
"Your company, your show. The Promise will back you either way."
"In that case," Von Geis said, "all in favor of the assault on Kuat?"
There were sounds of assent, forceful and determined, reluctant and soft, throughout the room. Only Hober, Mazoon, and Gadrin remained silent. And all three maintained neutral expressions. Namir couldn't read them.
"The vote is in favor," Von Geis said.
Namir felt no relief. Twilight Company would have died without a plan, but that was no guarantee it would survive with one. Still, he made himself smile. It was his plan, apparently, and now wasn't the time to show doubt.
"I suggest we break for a while and start preparing for takeoff," Hober said. "But there's one other thing we should decide first."
Namir looked at Hober quizzically, before the quartermaster's intent struck him. Beneath his stony expression, he fumed and wondered just how thoroughly Chalice had choreographed his fate. Waves of silica crashed against the wall of the amphitheater, spilling dust toward the shrinking tent city. Namir's sleeves flapped in the wind as he tried to shield his eyes and mouth. If the Thunderstrike wasn't prepped for departure within the hour, it would be caught in the fast-approaching windstorm. The company would be stuck on Uncural another night. Much as he was coming to loathe the planet, he wasn't sure he minded that idea. He turned away from the wall when he heard the sound of leather striking leather, the slow clapping of gloved hands from a few tiers down the aisle. Brand looked up at him, lips curled in amusement.
Congratulations, Captain, she said.
Namir grunted and began to descend the steps toward the track. Brand fell in at his side. Still First Sergeant, he said. Temporary command only, since they sure as hell weren't putting the governor in charge.
It's her plan, then?
Yes. Brand shrugged.
It's yours now.
Namir glanced over and saw that she'd raised her mask. You think it's the wrong call, he said.
The plan?
Brand shrugged again.
I have no idea. People have a lot of doubts, but they always do. And the troops trust you. It's good for morale.
Namir laughed. So I shouldn't worry about a mutiny?
Not even a little, Brand said.
They crossed the pod racing track together toward a cluster of soldiers carrying tents and generators back to the Thunderstrike. A few saluted Namir and laughed, but they kept their distance. Over the wind, Namir could hear the low moan and whine of the Corvette's engines coming to life. Thank you, he said softly, for saving the company.
My pleasure, Sergeant. You'll do right by it.
Her tone was steady, serious. But then she reached out suddenly and gripped his shoulder, and he thought he heard a note of humor in her voice.
Who knows? Brand said. With luck, maybe we'll even win.